morning. We're continuing the survey of the Old Testament, and our thanks to Jack for covering Daniel for us. And we're going to go back now to where we had stopped at the end of May, something like that, and when we finished, more or less, 2 Samuel. So we'll be picking up at 1 Kings. You might note that at this point, the people of God have been in the Promised Land for about 400 years, and they have about 400 more years in the Promised Land. So in that sense, we're halfway through their history between the time of the conquest and the time of the exile, in rough numbers. But let me talk a little bit about the Book of Kings in terms of its general nature, and then we'll turn to the first part of the book, in a sense. We'll cover part of it anyway. Kings, like Samuel, was originally one book. It's been divided into two books, partly just because of the length of space that it required on the scrolls when it was translated. Traditionally, it's been ascribed to Jeremiah. There are some questions about whether Jeremiah could have written the whole thing, because it covers part of the exile in Babylon at the very end, and Jeremiah went in the other direction at the Lord's command. But whether it was written by Jeremiah or a contemporary of his, it certainly has the touch of prophetic revelation, and I'll say a little bit about that as we go along. It draws, as you read the history, on the annals of the kings. And just to get an idea of that, turn with me to 1 Kings chapter 14. I didn't bring the marker board over, so all of our references will have to be given orally here. 1 Kings 14, if you look at verse 19, now this is the end of the history of Jeroboam. This is the Jeroboam the first, and he was the first king of the northern kingdom. I'm getting ahead of the story a little bit, but just to let you see how the writer acknowledges his sources. The rest of the acts of Jeroboam, how he made war and how he reigned, indeed, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. And then if you just look down toward the end of that chapter in verse 29, he's summarized Rehoboam's rule. So he would be the Solomon's son, the first to rule over the divided kingdom. Now the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So you see there the reference to the fact that there are more complete, in a sense, records that the writers refer to. And if you look, we won't look there, but if you look in 2 Chronicles, there's a reference to Isaiah, for example, as being one who helped to compile some of the history, 2 Chronicles 26, verse 22. So God, in his wisdom, inspired the prophetic writer to compile the history from existing histories, but there's a particular point behind it. And as we emphasized when we looked at Joshua and Judges and so on, history doesn't come without a context. History comes with a particular viewpoint. And in this case, of course, it's the divine viewpoint. And God emphasizes his working in history with a particular point here toward the history of redemption. So in this case, the book of Kings covers the time from Solomon, the son of David, until the going into exile, as I've already mentioned, a period of about 400 years. After Solomon reigned, the kingdom was divided in the time of his son Rehoboam. And so the writer then traces these two histories, the history of the northern kingdom, which is actually where most of the tribes were affiliated, and the history of the southern kingdom, which preserved the promises given to David, in a sense. And he has this way of weaving together the two histories. I'm sure you've read the book and you're familiar with this. He'll treat kings for a while until another one comes up in the southern kingdom, and then when he finishes that one off, he deals with that one and goes back and forth like that. So that way of interweaving the history is helpful in letting us see the interactions between the two kingdoms. But what I want to particularly emphasize is how the kings are evaluated. And for that, let's turn over. Actually, we were pretty close in our last time. First 1 Kings 15. I'm going to close my Bible here. Verses 3 through 5. Now, this is one of the kings of the southern kingdom, Abijam, king of Judah. And notice the evaluation of his kingship, which is given. This is at the beginning of the account of his rule. And he, Abijam, walked in all the sins of his father, which he had done before him. His heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. Nevertheless, for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, by setting up his son after him, and by establishing Jerusalem. Because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and had not turned aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. Now, you can see in this passage that David is, in a sense, the standard of comparison. If you want a human standard of comparison, it's the way that David ruled, and in particular the fact that David's heart was loyal to the Lord. Now, that's not to say that David was sinless. Ultimately, the standard is not David the person, but the law by which David walked, and I'll get to that in a minute. But the emphasis here is the comparison to David as the ideal king to whom all the successive kings were to line up. Now, that comparison with David is especially connected with the preservation of the true worship of God. That's something that is particularly emphasized in Chronicles, which covers a parallel history in which we introduced back in May sometime. But here also it's important to remember that the assessment of the king is in terms of how he had respect to the worship of God. And you can see that even if you look down a little bit in the same chapter in verse 11. Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as did his father David. Okay, so there's the same comparison. We've gone from Abijam to his son Asa. And he banished the perverted persons from the land and removed all the idols that his fathers had made. So you see there, and this is typical of the assessment of a good king, and that is that he had respect to the worship of God. Now, of course, that's the worship as is set out in the law, so it's a particular emphasis on obedience to that aspect of the law. But you shouldn't just think in terms of, did this guy meet the standard or did this guy not? You should remember that God had made a promise to David, and God does not forget his promises. God is faithful even when men are unfaithful. And you can see that even in the verse we first read about Abijam. This is important because Abijam didn't rise to the level of David. But notice in verse 4, nevertheless, for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem. God had promised that the Messiah would come through David. And even though some of David's sons were unfaithful in following after him, God made sure that his promise was fulfilled. And so even in the darkest times in the southern kingdom, and there are some very dark times, like when Athaliah apparently has extinguished the entire seed of David, yet God preserves a lamp for David's sake, ultimately going back to the promise in the garden that God would raise up the seed of the woman to crush the head of the serpent. And so that's an important theme. It's not merely, was this guy good enough or was this guy not good enough? It's God's faithfulness in the face of men who often fail to be faithful in walking with God. There were about 19 kings, if you count Athaliah, who wasn't a king. I don't think she was really a queen either. But if you count her, I guess there are 20 or so. And of those, maybe 8 are counted faithful to God. 2 are really highly praised, Hezekiah and Josiah. But it's telling that in both of their cases, part of their praiseworthiness came from the fact that they were willing to reform from the corruptions that came before them. And so most of the kings of the southern kingdom are criticized the way Abijam is here in chapter 15 in the opening verses. On the other hand, how about the kings of the northern kingdom, which is usually called Israel? This is maybe a confusing point at first to a student of the Bible. You have Judah and you have Israel. Now, before this point in history, Judah was just a tribe in Israel, but now Judah is the kingdom and Israel is the kingdom, which consists of all the other tribes except Israel and some remnants from others. But Israel is the name for the northern kingdom that's typically given during this period. How about their kings? They were all condemned as wicked, every one of them. If you want someone who set the standard, it would be the low standard, and that is Jeroboam, the first of the kings. And it's often said this so-and-so followed in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. And when we get there, we'll see it. It was specifically a refusal to follow God's command in worship and setting up other places of worship, which eventually became places for worshiping other gods also. Now, that's an important thing to remember because you see the fact that the promises given to David are traced through the southern kingdom, through the sons of David. In the northern kingdom, there is, in a sense, a general promise of God because he will not have his people cut off. He will preserve a remnant, as Elijah learned, even among a kingdom like that. And yet, you can see the contrast. How many dynasties were there in the southern kingdom? I've heard this is a good Bible quiz question. The answer is one or two. If you want to start with David, there was only one. If you want to count Saul, there were two. How many dynasties were in the northern kingdom? A bunch. Okay, I don't know if that would work on the Bible quiz or not, but there were a lot. And you know, the longest dynasty was just maybe two or three or four successions. Typically, they only went for one or two generations. And so you can see there again that the preservation of the line, having a dynasty like that is not, you might say, a natural thing. Just look around the world now. You don't have long-standing successions of rulers. It was God's faithfulness. And in that sense, the northern kingdom stands as a stark contrast to remind us that this is what will happen apart from the covenant promises of God. Another thing to emphasize the divine viewpoint in this is, if you were to ask who after Solomon was the most prominent king out of all of these in the northern and southern kingdoms, and I'm thinking in terms of secular histories and records, you couldn't really expect to find, you'd be surprised, I guess I would say, in terms of the way the Bible treats that person. The answer is Omri. Omri was a very well-known king among the kings of his generation. And in the Bible, he gets maybe five verses, and he's called wicked, and that's about it. And he has a wicked son who is much more familiar to us, Ahab. But that shows the emphasis that the writer has. It's not men who are particularly prominent in worldly terms, although certainly Solomon was. It's his own point of view in emphasizing God's working in history. In contrast to someone like Omri, the writer of the Kings spends much more of his time, in fact, a surprisingly large portion of time, in talking about Elijah and Elisha, who were prophets in that time period, particularly with Omri's son. But those points of view are really turned upside down. And again, that's important. If you've ever studied a secular history of the period or of any other period where we have biblical material, you might wonder whether they're talking about the same period at all, right? Are you talking about the same period of history that I know when you describe this? And of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that their facts are wrong, although quite often they are. It's really the point of view of what's important in history. And here the writer gives us what's important in history. And what's important is in this relatively insignificant and obscure part of the world, although by God's providence it was a place of much traffic through the trade routes, yet in this relatively obscure part of the world, God was bringing forth his son, preparing to bring forth his son in history. And that prominence of the history of redemption in this account is an important thing to remember. Now, that's a general introduction to the book of Kings. And what I want to do now is turn a little bit to look at the life of Solomon. Let me pause and see if you have any comments or questions so far. A rare opportunity. Dave.
I don't want to draw too close an analogy, but when the Florida elections last presidential season reminded me, as I was thinking about Kings during that time, there's, you know, political loyalties and people devising scheming have always been with us. Yeah. And here we have the Bush family that, I don't want to use the word dynasty in too strong of a sense, but trying to at least preserve some political legacy and trying to get this son elected and all the troubles and the maneuvering and the lawyers and courts involved to try to bring this about. When I read Kings and I look at this and I say, God in his providence preserved for this country and for the sake of his servant David, you know, hundreds of years. Yeah. And here we can't even get, you know, 12 years, 8 years or so with one family trying to assert itself to develop its own legacy. You know, lots of people aspire to political power, and it was no different in the days of Israel and Judah. And it was God superimposing and orchestrating events to preserve this promise made to David. And that is no small feat, given the effort of the kingdom of the darkness and the effort of the ambitions of men to assert their own authority and their own agenda at these times. In my mind, that was a pretty interesting picture of how God, especially in the time when it looked like there was one heir left and it was hanging on by a hair. I found it very refreshing to see how God, in writing his own history, had an agenda, and he accomplished it exactly the way he intended to.
That's a good example. Brian?
A lot of times in the old times, though, the king went out to the battle, and God took care of him one way or another in the battle, and our kings don't go out in the battle. So,
interesting point, yeah.
There's no dynasty being preserved. There's no, or being trying to make a dynasty, and you know our leaders are pretty insulated from taking any risks other than political risks.
That's true.
Dave brought up a couple of weeks ago the preservation of history. If you look at it, is like you said, it doesn't compare to the Bible, which obviously brings into question how well the historians have recorded the events of history, and also the indictment of the how God looks at a king and says, just like you said, we can apply that to our own lives.
That's right. Yeah, the one or two times I've ever been at an event and then seen it actually recorded in a newspaper or magazine, I've kind of wondered, why do I read this newspaper or magazine at all? I was there, that's not what happened. But if journalists can't get it right, then how can historians? One wonders, anyway. We're thankful for a divinely inspired history. Okay, after that aside about journalism, my plan is to... this week, look at the life of Solomon. So that covers chapters 1 through 11 of 1 Kings, except for a big part in the middle, which is the building of the temple. And I think what I'd like to do is take some time next week to look at that. We already looked at the preparations for it, but especially Solomon's prayer is so significant and such a beautiful example of prayer that I'd like to take some time to look at that. So this week, we'll be looking from the beginning to the end of the life of Solomon, but leaving out part in the middle. And if you want to look ahead, Lord willing, what I'd like to do after that is to look at some of the associated literature, which is usually associated with the name of Solomon, or which is generally wisdom literature. So that would be Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. And then pick up the history of the kings after that. I hope as we go along that we can incorporate some of the books that were written at a similar time, some of the prophetic material as we go through. Okay, the life of Solomon then. Now, you may be familiar with this from your own reading, but it was not even an immediate thing that David's choice for his heir should sit on the throne, having talked just now about that confusion. So if you look back at the opening Kings, chapters of Kings, chapters 1 and 2, and you might flip back there, you can see the story of Adonijah and his aspirations. So if you look, for example, in 1 Kings chapter 1, beginning in verse 5, Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. And a sad note in verse 6 about David's failure as a father. His father had not rebuked him. Why have you done so? But Adonijah was the fourth son of David. He was next in line after Absalom in terms of the normal order of succession. However, David had not chosen that he would rule. He had chosen Solomon. Solomon was a son by Bathsheba. And Adonijah then, in essence, has himself installed as king. And that's the record of what happened. The record of that is in the rest of 1 Kings and some of the consequences of that following on to it. It was a very difficult time because some of those who had been loyal to David followed Adonijah, and some of them followed Solomon or David, depending on how you want to look at it. In particular, Joab, who had been the military leader, and Abiathar, who had been the priest, both went with Adonijah. Now, I'm not going to look at the details of this, or we'll never get through the 11 chapters, but there were a lot of intrigue here. Nathan and Bathsheba on one side trying to convince David that he needed to do something, and the others on the other side. Eventually, David does agree that Solomon will rule and agrees to act to that end. And you can see the conclusion of that in the disposal, as it were, of the enemies of David and Solomon who were involved in this revolt. What I'd like to do instead is to focus a bit on the charge that David gives to Solomon, because this ties in with the standard that I was talking about. Remember, I said the standard, in a sense, was David, but it was David as he was walking in the ways of God. And so I'd like to read 1 Kings chapter 2, some of the verses here. I think I'll read verses 1 through 4. Now the days of David drew near that he should die, and he charged Solomon his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man. And keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do, and wherever you turn. That the Lord may fulfill his word which he spoke concerning me, saying, If your sons take heed to their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, he said, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Now you can see here the charge of David is clearly connecting the Davidic covenant, okay, which is what he talks about with not lacking a man to sit on the throne of Israel, with the Mosaic covenant. That is the statutes of the law of Moses. And this again is to emphasize the fact that the working of God in history was not in fits and starts or in completely disconnected pieces, but that God has one plan which he's working out by successive covenant revelations. And in particular, the emphasis here on the law of Moses and the commandments and the statutes as being the standard by which the sons of David were to walk. Now, it's interesting to note that the way to prove yourself a man is to walk in the ways of the Lord. I'm not sure that that's a particularly popular standard for manhood these days, but it's a striking phrase that was there, at least in the New King James. That's the way Solomon was to prove himself a man. Now, of course, by the end of the story, we'll see that Solomon distorted that picture and proved himself a man in his own eyes in a different and unlawful way, by multiplying wives. But the account that follows after this in verses 5 and following, we actually alluded to earlier. David, well, to put it in blunt terms, tells Solomon how to dispose of his enemies. And I made the point before, and I won't go over it again, that I think you should see these men who are mentioned here as threats to the kingdom. Certainly Abner was a threat to the kingdom. I'm sorry, Joab was a threat to the kingdom. And Shimei is a man that it was in that context that we had talked about this before. So I won't dwell on that part, but it's important to see at the very beginning the charge given to Solomon by his father is in terms of the standard, which then is repeated, although often in terms of David, and for the later kings. Now, what follows I'm going to cover fairly briefly, but if you look over at chapter 3, you can see the beginning of the process of Solomon coming to rule. I'm not sure if that's a very good way to say it, but Solomon has this remarkable experience in which he goes to a high place, and God appears to him in a dream. And this is a well-known account in which Solomon asks for wisdom, and God praises that request. And I'm going to read only part of it. So if you look over in verses 12 and 13, I'm sorry, that's not a very good place to start. Let me pick up at 1 Kings 3:10. The speech pleased the Lord. This is Solomon's request for wisdom to govern the people. That Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after you. And I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days. So if you walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. And it's striking that as a result of this dream, the first action of Solomon is to abandon the high place and to go, it says in verse 15, to come to Jerusalem and stand before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. So I'll return, I'll try to explain that a bit next week, but this, there's a continual tension, isn't the right word, a continual sin of turning to the high places. At this point, there's probably not quite as much involved with the worship of other gods, and yet you see immediately after this instruction that Solomon turns to the place of worship that God had appointed. Okay, what follows then is a description of the greatness of Solomon's reign, of his wisdom and of the glory of his kingdom. He ruled for 40 years, which is the same as his father had ruled. So it was a long rule, again, by common standards. There's a familiar story at the end of chapter 3 about his wisdom in the two women who were contending over a baby. And what follows after that talks about the great wisdom of Solomon in chapter 4. Let me just point out one aspect of that. Again, I have a point to which I'm aiming, and it, as it often happens, recedes quickly into out of hope's distance. But look at verse 33 of chapter 4. This is a description of the wisdom of Solomon after talking about the Proverbs, for example, in verse 32. Says, he spoke of trees from the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And men of all nations from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Now, I'll try to make the point at the end, but Solomon is seen as the ideal king. In that sense, he is a foreshadowing of Christ. But here you can, in a sense, see him as an ideal Adam. Here he has the sort of wisdom in what's usually called natural science that Adam had at the beginning when he named the animals. And that's important because usually when people think of ancient cultures which contributed to sort of the wisdom of the ages, they don't think of the Hebrew culture as particularly foundational for science. They may look to the Greeks or the Romans. Certainly for mathematics, they often look to the Greeks. All their cultures did a lot. But you see here something which emphasizes that aspect of the original commandment given to Adam and Eve in the garden, that is, that they should subdue the earth. That here David, in this glorious condition, is working that out in a way full of wisdom. Now, having said that, interlaced with the glory that we'll be talking about through these chapters are some undertones that are rather ominous. And you only have to look back up at least in my Bible, at the top of that page, verse 26. Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. you know, guy liked horses. So that sounds okay. But if you think back in history, in Deuteronomy 17, there are warnings that kings love power. And one of the things it was said that the kings would like to do was to get a lot of horses. You know, it's kind of hard to make the modern analogy of that, but you can imagine what horses contributed in terms of prestige and power and so on. So not only in that passage, and you know, again, I didn't bring the marker board, it was Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 16 specifically, and also in 1 Samuel chapter 8, where Samuel warns them of the king they desire and what he will want to do, you get the sense that not only does Solomon have all of this glory, but it comes at a price. And it's not exactly clear as you go along what the price is. And I think that's part of the writer's intention through the first part is to emphasize the glory of his rule. And so it's not particularly developed. But I wanted to make that point while we were in this chapter. Chapters 5 through 9, we're going to skip over for now. They talk about the building both of the temple and of his own palace, Solomon's own palace, and the beautiful prayer that I've already mentioned in connection with the consecration of the temple. I'd like to turn over to look at what you might call the high point of Solomon's glory, and that's given especially at the end of chapter 9 and the beginning of chapter 10. There are references here to commerce, international commerce, you know, what the foreign trade deficit was. They probably weren't as concerned about as some economists, but there's a remarkable statement here of the fleet of ships in verse 26 of chapter 9 of the international trade, of the gold that was involved. And perhaps the crowning account of all of these is at the beginning of chapter 10 when the Queen of Sheba comes, because hearing of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord. And her testimony is a remarkable one in the middle part here. Let me just read verse 9 out of her testimony. Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord has loved Israel forever, therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness. So you see here, out of the mouth of a Gentile, the acknowledgement that God has fulfilled his promises to David. And she is a remarkable testimony of that grace shown in Solomon's time. Just as a matter of interest, Sheba is usually identified with the Southern Arabia Peninsula, as our friends who are serving there as missionaries like to point out. That's modern-day Yemen. And so we can pray that that same understanding of God's will in history will come to those who are bound in the darkness of a false religion. However, after this point in chapter 10, and a description of the greatness of the glory and the many people who came to hear the wisdom of God. If you look over at chapter 10, verse 24, all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom. It wasn't just the Queen of Sheba. It was a very impressive demonstration of the wisdom of God's law shown forth in Solomon's reign. There is a sad single word at the beginning of chapter 11, and that is the word "but." But King Solomon loved many foreign women. So not really giving perhaps due proportion to the glory of his kingdom that the writer does, but that's the nature of a survey. The writer then turns to describe the many wives whom Solomon had. And it's not just that he multiplied wives, but they were wives outside of the covenant community. And there are wives who thereby turned his heart after other gods, as it says in verse 4. Now, the writer here, as is so consistent in the Bible, does not pass over the sins of the person he's describing. He says specifically in verse 2, the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. But Solomon, it says, clung to these and loved. So the sad story that follows is Solomon, after having built this glorious temple to the true God, then follows the idolatry of his wives so much that in verse 7 he builds a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem. And he does likewise for his foreign wives in verse 8. Now, the judgment that comes is the division of the kingdom. And I think what I'll do is wait to describe that when we pick up the story again in 1 Kings. So in that sense, I guess I'm not getting all the way through chapter 11. But that's really setting up the division of the kingdom. But you notice it says in verse 11 the reason specifically. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this idolatry, and have not kept my covenant and my statutes which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Again, there's an emphasis on the mercy of God. Not only that he doesn't do it in Solomon's time, but also that he does not destroy the kingdom altogether and raise up another one the way he had done with Saul. Now, if you think back on the life of Solomon, of a man of so much wisdom, given so much such privilege by God, you marvel at this conclusion of his life. And I think historically, I believe this is fair to say, and Reformed commentators have pointed to the book of Ecclesiastes as giving the real end of the story. Now, there is some question about dating the book of Ecclesiastes and who is the author, but it certainly does incorporate some of the thought of Solomon. And one can hope that at the end of his life, Solomon realized the vanity of all that he had done and the emptiness of the glory that he had sought apart from God. The writers often don't sort of satisfy our interest in the personal destinies of people like that. That is, the writer has a particular interest in the flow of covenant history, and so he may not tell us all the details of what happened in the life. Manasseh, for example, is only described in Kings as a wicked king, but in Chronicles we have the extra information that he repented at the end of his life. And so it's a little hard to say exactly what the details were at the very end of Solomon's life. But what's absolutely clear is that this great wickedness had severe implications for the kingdom. But I'd like to make one application of that and then turn to think about Solomon as he is in his ideal situation, that type of Christ. So if you would, turn with me over to the book of Nehemiah. So Kings, Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah. I did the simple thing of looking in a concordance to see where Solomon's name appeared, and I was struck by this reference to Solomon in Nehemiah. Remember, Nehemiah is at the time after the return from the exile, and in their time, they had the same problem. And there you might say it was more understandable, if not more innocent. It was that they were surrounded by the nations in a way that Solomon had no excuse about. But in any case, the problem of intermarriage with unbelievers was a severe problem in Nehemiah's time. So did I give the right reference? Nehemiah chapter 13 and verse 23. Did I give the right reference there?
You had to get
it. Oh, sorry. I just said Nehemiah. Okay, there we go. Nehemiah 13:23, toward the very end of the book. In those days I also saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And he describes the confusion that came with that. But it was very striking to me the rebuke that he gave. And so notice verse 26. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. Should we then hear of your doing all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women? Now, what's striking about this is that he says even Solomon was brought into sin by this. And his point is what makes you think that it won't turn you away also? This is, I think, a sober reminder, especially for us parents, and I'll say directly to the fathers, to warn the sons are particularly emphasized here as Solomon and Nehemiah, that they should not think that they can escape the influence of marrying a woman who does not fall in the ways of the Lord, and I would say does not agree with his understanding of what the Scriptures teach about the way of salvation. It's a very important thing for us to remind our children, and I'd say especially our sons, of the snare that this is, and to say even Solomon could not escape the consequences of it. That's for one point of application, but I'd like to step back then in terms of the history of redemption, and sort of slightly changing the emphasis to think of the how Solomon stands in history. And for that, I'd like for us to turn to the book of Psalms, Psalm 72. Now, I can't develop this thought very well. I'm not only talking about my own limited abilities, but also that I don't have a lot of time. Solomon is referred to often as the beloved of God. You may have noticed that even in what I read in Nehemiah. And that's partly alluding to the name that God gave him. Remember, David and Bathsheba gave him the name of Solomon. But it says the Lord, in the passage in 2 Samuel 12, 24, it says the Lord loved Solomon, and he specifically sent a prophet to say that his name would be Jedidiah, beloved of the Lord. And so that's a striking thing, not only for thinking about the end of Solomon's life, but also for thinking about who was the truly beloved Son of God. And it was the Lord Jesus Christ. And so Christ himself in the New Testament, when he speaks of the heavy responsibility of those who heard him and rejected him, would say, you know, even the Queen of Sheba came to hear Solomon, and she will stand up in the judgment and condemn you, because a greater than Solomon is here. And that idea, particularly of one greater than Solomon, is developed, may be too strong a word, but I think is clearly pictured in Psalm 72. Psalm 72 is not referred to in the New Testament explicitly as a messianic psalm, and yet you can see at the beginning it's a psalm of Solomon, as I mentioned when we looked at some of the titles of the psalms, whether that's by Solomon or a psalm for Solomon. Certainly the Solomonic rule, that's an adjective, is prevalent here. Just read through this and you can see the description of the ideal king. He rules, verse 2, with righteousness and justice. There's justice even to the poor. There's a description of kings, and you notice in verse 10, even Sheba and Seba are mentioned there as bringing gifts, kings coming before him. So you see a description in Psalm 72 of the great abundance, even down to the gold that we saw in Solomon's rule in verse 15 mentioned here, the gold of Sheba being brought, given to him. So you see the glory of, which might well describe the rule of Solomon. Yeah, this is a striking example, because not only does Solomon not fit the picture in terms of the problems of his rule, but no earthly king could fit this description. Because it says in verse 5, they shall fear you as long as the sun and moon endure throughout all generations. And for example, in verse 7, in his days the righteous shall flourish and abundance of peace until the moon is no more. And even the description of the extent of Solomon's rule, which if you want a reference, in 1 Kings 4:21, it's given really to the extent of the promise that God ever gave for the promised land, from the Euphrates to the Mediterranean Sea in modern terms. And yet those bounds are moved in verse 8. It says, he shall have dominion also from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. See, this is not a description merely of Solomon's rule. This is a description of the dominion of the Messiah over all the earth. And thus it harkens back, as I emphasized with Abraham, that the land, as the land of Palestine, was the beachhead. It was the whole of the earth which was to be redeemed, because it was the whole of the earth which had been given to Adam and Eve in the garden. And so you see here the beauty of this psalm is that it says, in essence, here is the true Adam. Here is the one whose rule goes from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. You can't get any a greater extent of rule than that on the earth. And that's then an emphasis here that the homage of the kings, the gifts, and those who come to him, in the case of Solomon, are only a small picture of the progress of the gospel and of its ultimate success in bringing even nations to himself. And since we conveniently just had a study on that subject, I don't need to talk any more about it. But it is emphasized here that it's not merely men as individuals, but kings. And the idea always is that the king then brings with him his rule and the kingdom. And so Solomon, although we may look at his life under a microscope, and actually it doesn't have to be too fine a resolution of a microscope to see the sins of Solomon and his corruption, yet the scriptures would have us, in a sense, step back and see, you know, David was promised a son who would build the temple. And in a literal sense, Solomon did that. And yet the great fulfillment of that promise in 2 Samuel 7 is truly this one whose temple is so built that even the ends of the earth come and worship him, and the nations serve him. The Solomon stands for us as a picture of Christ, as the truly beloved one of the Lord, and as the one not one who should be measured by David's standards, but really the ultimate one who follows in God's way and is obedient to the point of death. Okay, any comments or questions either on that part or the whole study? No comments? What's the matter with you people? Yeah. You've been cowed into silence by my predecessors, particularly Mr. Carroll. Mr. Kreider always gave opportunities. In fact, he provoked opportunities. But, just kidding. It really is true that the study in Messiah the Prince ties in very well with this study, in particular with the rule of Solomon as foreshadowing the rule of Christ. There we go.
What you said, a lot of the Proverbs talk about the strange woman and don't be foolish yet, and supposedly Solomon wrote those, but it's strange that he would put that out, but still, he himself, inspired by God, could not keep it.
Yeah. That's a... Yeah, it's a remarkable thing to study that and to study the book of Proverbs, and the word disconnect comes to mind.
Just how frail our humanity is at keeping God's law, only by His mercy do we do it.
Yeah, that's right. Amen.